Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, welcome. Today we're focusing on how it takes ordinary, everyday people to effect change in our world. We'll talk with journalist Lydia Danworth about the toxic truth. Danworth followed the true story of two courageous men who used science to expose industry's concealment about the number one environmental threat to our children and ourselves. This is something that I thought had been resolved 30 years ago, more than that, but apparently not, and it still affects tens of thousands of children nationwide every year. We'll also talk with a physical therapist out of Detroit. When his father died, Eric Tomei channeled his grief into an opportunity to not only help others to appreciate their loved ones, but also to raise money for his father's favorite charity, Habitat for Humanity. But first, I'm talking with two people who've traveled the globe in search of the meaning of peace. They say we must give peace a deadline and say that together we can create it within 5 years. Nathan Otto and Amber Lupton co-founded Dharma Mix, an internet-based social venture media company, and together they authored Give Peace a Deadline, What Ordinary People Can Do to Cause World Peace in 5 Years. Nathan and Amber, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Vicki.
Thank you, Vicki. Great to be with you.
I wanted to start off with just tell us a little bit about your background. Nathan, I know you had very interesting grandparents.
Yes, I grew up in an entrepreneurial environment, and I took that into the business world and started several companies, a couple of which did fairly well. And then I sold those and wanted to focus on something bigger.
And your grandparents actually were the founders of Gore-Tex, the material that most of us know, especially in the Pacific Northwest. Yeah. We're very familiar with it.
If the weather's horrible, it's a good day for Gore-Tex. and it's still a family-owned company.
Well, that's amazing. And Amber, you've worked with a great many people. You've studied from a young age with teachers such as Tony Robbins, Deepak Chopra.
I've been kind of a transformational maverick from the time I was 11, and had what I call kind of an empathetic awakening at 11, and dedicated my life to God, and had amazing parents who just gave me books and books and books to read, from Louise Hay to Brian Tracy. And I was walking on hot coals with Tony at 15 and, assisting with Deepak at 18 and Wayne Dyer and most of the big names I got to hang out with at a very young age. And one of the biggest lessons that they taught me is how to think for myself, critical thinking. And I think that this sort of movement, Giving Peace a Deadline, would not be possible without that important lesson that my teachers gave me.
Mm. So let's talk about that. Let's talk about the title of the book, Give Peace a Deadline, What Ordinary People Can Do to Cause World Peace in 5 Years. This sounds fantastic. Tell us a little bit about how you came to this conclusion, and obviously you believe it's realistic.
Well, the most important thing is to understand what we mean when we say peace, because most people feel like peace is a vague dream that can never be attained. And what we understood is that there's 6 or 7 levels of conflict, depending what systems you look at. And only the top level or the worst level is violent political conflict or war. And as long as we create world systems and agreements that keep the levels of conflict outside of war, then we have peace. Even though we may not all agree, we may not feel inner peace, we may still have, serious disagreements, we can nevertheless resolve our conflicts in a dignified way.
Right. So when we say peace, we don't mean the absence of conflict. We don't mean a lifestyle, a utopian ideology. We mean the end to politically organized violence and the legitimacy of that.
Mm. You say, actually, throughout your work, forget hippie peace, as we think traditionally, and nicey nice. It comes from this political vein.
Yeah, well, we noticed that we didn't need to be nicer to give women the right to vote. We didn't need to be nicer or to solve all of the world's problems to end institutional slavery. And so we've just looked at what is the era that we're born into? What are the challenges, the agreements? And then what are the agreements that would reflect our values? And one of those agreements is to handle conflict while it's in a level 1 through 6 before it escalates to violent conflict.
Now, you both traveled the world. Did you travel the world together? And was it with the intent of looking at different countries and different cultures, different religions, and seeing how they define peace?
Oh, absolutely. Though we're the authors of this book, we had about 100 advisors. We've met with Madeleine Albright to Paul Wolfowitz. You know, Nathan met the Dalai Lama before we even came up with this idea, and recently got him on video talking about giving peace a deadline as a good idea. And looking at talking to the people who've been in this field for decades of how do we create world peace by this date? How would you do it? How could ordinary people participate? Because I think many times, just ordinary citizens, we think, oh, I don't have the power to do that. My government's going to do it. And that's only a half-truth, especially in the United States where we are the government. And one thing we found out through these leaders around the world is the power of the individuals and individuals mobilizing influence institutions, influence government. And that's what we're doing with P5Y.
Now, P5Y means peace in 5 years, but you
exactly.
You actually had a launch for this movement that you're trying to create, trying to get more people involved with. You threw parties in major cities. What has happened so far? This happened in February, I believe, right?
It's been a few weeks since we've launched in all these cities. We've had many people come to us with resources and commitments. Amber and I have personally promised world peace by February 14th, 2014, and anyone can take that pledge. Since our launch, hundreds of people have taken the same pledge, made the same promise to the world to create that. And so there's a lot of momentum being created.
Right.
Yes, we were, an IT team has been donated to create the next version of P5Y.org. We've had CEOs take the pledge who personally promised to create world peace. We've had people on both sides of major conflicts personally promised to create world peace by this deadline. And so it's gaining momentum from a wide spectrum of socioeconomic levels. And we had launch cities in 12 cities around the world, from Ireland to Peru to Uganda. It's not just a U.S. movement. This is a global movement of people the majority who want peace, saying, I'm willing to take an action for it. I'm willing to create a peace team. I'm willing to get a peace buddy. I'm willing to make my personal plan and collaborate with a global network to really make this happen in our lifetime.
Okay, so let's look at that a little bit, because you've both used the term personal responsibility. I'm taking personal responsibility to ensure world peace. And some might say that sounds a little arrogant or romanticized. How do you respond to that?
Well, Thomas Edison didn't know how he was going to invent the electrical light bulb when he declared he would do it. Martin Luther King didn't know how the civil rights movement was going to turn out.
Mm-hmm.
There's a certain belief that someone else will do it for me. And we just looked at leadership throughout history, that it all starts with an individual. And today with technology, with communication, an 8-year-old has access to know what's happening on the other side of the world, where only an aristocrat had that access 100 years ago. We've only had the World Wide Web since 1993. So we each have so much more power and a voice. And you know this, Vicki, being in media, that media has such a potent role to play in creating a future either of peace or of conflict. No matter what, we're perpetuating something. And what is it that we're perpetuating?
Right.
And as individuals, we're seeing we can perpetuate peace on the planet for real.
So let's look at taking personal responsibility. If somebody wants to get involved in your P5Y movement, what kind of steps do you encourage people to take?
I would encourage them to get a copy of our book, Give Peace a Deadline, which is also available online in a condensed version for a free download. Go through the book. By the end of that book, a person will have their own plan for how to create peace in 5 years and how they can participate from their skills, their passions, and how they're already spending their time. So that creating peace from an individual's life, from your life, isn't about stopping what you're doing and going to do something special that makes peace. It's about looking at the ways you can contribute from who you are already. And that's the power of this movement. As people contribute from their strengths, it grows. And what we add as P5Y.org is collaboration. So going to P5Y.org and registering is one of the concrete steps someone can take.
Okay. And is that where people can also get the abridged free download if they choose to go that way?
Yes.
P5Y.org. Okay.
Yes. And givepeaceadeadline.com goes to the same place. And sometimes it's easier to remember givepeaceadeadline.com.
Okay. All right. Well, when we come back, I want to look at why 5 years. You've given a deadline of 2014, and I want to go into that with you. You're listening to Conversations Live. Please stay with us. My guests are Nathan Otto and Amber Lupton. Their book, Give Peace a Deadline. We'll be right back.
Now I've been happy lately, thinking about the good things to come, and I believe it could be something good has begun.
Why? Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
Hi, this is Julie Forbes. Join me on Wednesday afternoons from 2 to 3 p.m. for the Dog Talk Show, an evolved perspective on life with dogs. Listen to discussions on dog-related topics and call in to voice your opinion or ask my opinion about your dog. We will talk about everything from dog behavior to pet food to dog training programs in prisons. The Dog Talk Show, an evolved perspective on life with dogs. I'm your host, Julie Forbes. Tune in Wednesdays from 2 to 3 p.m. on Alternative Talk 1150.
Write it down, shout it loud. Alternative Talk 1150 AM. Now, wasn't that fun?
Someday it's going to come. Cause out on the edge of darkness, there rides a peace train. Oh, peace train, take this country. Come take me home again.
And welcome back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. My guests in this segment are Nathan Otto and Amber Lupton. They're the authors of Give Peace a Deadline. And we're talking today throughout the show about how it takes ordinary, everyday people to effect change in our world. And I wanted to ask you, Nathan and Amber, you set this deadline of 2014. You said we can do it in 5 years. How did you come to that conclusion?
Well, it's a well-researched conclusion. We were looking at the whole world of how people plan their lives. Most people can plan for 5 years, but not more. So anybody can envision something occurring in 5 years and place themselves in that future and look back and see how that happened. We also looked at research by Steven Pinker, who's a Harvard polymath. He was looking at data from the University of Maryland on conflicts in the last 100 years. He analyzed this data, and he concluded that we're in the most peaceful time in history right now. The trend is towards peace. The chances of being killed in a violent conflict are lower than they've ever been statistically living on Earth.
Hard for us to believe, isn't it? When we see everything that's going on.
Well, it is difficult to believe, but with everything that's going on, that gets us to our next source, which is Strauss and Howe, who are these respected demographers in Washington, D.C., wrote a book called The Fourth Turning. And they say that every 80 to 100 years, there's a brief period of time, it's 5 to 15 years, that they call a crisis, when everything is basically open to create new agreements, when ordinary people are willing to take action to create world change. And we're in a crisis right now. We're in an open moment of history where anybody taking action has a disproportionate effect on the whole world. So we feel an urgency to take advantage of this open moment.
You talk about action through access. Tell us what you mean by that.
Well, one thing we see is that as humanity, though Nathan and I don't have all of the answers, we know as humanity we have answers and resource and genius. And so P5Y is organizing, or P5Y for Peace in 5 Years, is organizing groups of experts in conflict resolution, in government, in media, so that we have advisors, so we answer the question for any person, what can I do? to help create peace in 5 years.
And the principle is to make it user-friendly, to chunk it down, to sort of almost consumerize peace, because everything else has been consumerized and marketed to us. Let's use these same tools to create what we call weapons of mass collaboration, so that anyone can know not only what to do, but why they're doing it in order to move the ball towards this goal of delegitimizing war.
And we were speaking to John Perkins, author of Confessions of an Economic Hitman, and he said that corporations are the new empire, and that's the bad news, but that's also the good news, because they respond to us as consumers. And just like the green movement has taken on quite a momentum in the last 5 years, we're looking at creating a consumer guide in the next 2 years so that when you go shopping at Target or Walmart or Whole Foods, that you know when you pick up that bottle of detergent, if the product has gone to create violent conflict or if it's gone to peaceful conflict. So to create transparency with these transnational corporations about who's involved in killing and who's involved in peace.
Okay, so if I understand what you're saying, we can look up on the website, or we will be able to look up on the website, which corporations spend their money where to support what?
Yes, in 2010, we'll have the consumer guide.
Okay. So which corporations, let's say that we want to start holding corporations and leaders accountable, which obviously we should do. But where do we start with that?
We start with what are called the extractive industries. Paul Collier, who was an economist for the World Bank, wrote a book called The Bottom Billion, and he describes in detail how in our current ways of doing business, corporations who want to get at basic resources like lumber and oil and minerals often go into poor countries, and they put so much money into those resources that those countries enter civil wars trying to control them and control that resource. And it's not so much the fault of these corporations, although some of them are, you know, what one might consider bad. It's really the system where there's no transparency except for diamonds, where we have this idea of blood diamonds and, you know, conflict-free diamonds. That's evolved, and that's a great model. But it really starts with those industries supporting civil wars in poor countries. But there's many other places to look as well.
Yeah, and I mean, our government has also been involved in that over the generations, right?
Very much. It's been a kind of economic imperialism. And that's what we've inherited from the past. But in order to create a future where we can all thrive, we need to do something different.
Okay. You talk about peace buddy up with a peace buddy. What do you mean by that, and how can that be effective?
Well, we've just seen that when one takes on a higher purpose that is just beyond one's family or community, but really is for the whole world, that it helps to have a friend involved. And many people who feel the calling of peace in their own lives, they have other friends who have that calling. And there's a system and exercises of we can help each other with our peace plans. We can look at where does my purpose, activities, and skills overlap. And there's a whole chapter on what kind of peacemaker are you and various exercises and give peace a deadline that you can do with your peace buddy that's fun and creative, and it adds a whole nother level of camaraderie into this process.
Give me an example of what a peacemaker, what different kinds of peacemakers there are.
Well, one exercise is to draw three circles on a page. One with activities, one is your skills, and one is your passions. And filling out all of those circles and looking at where do those overlap so that I have a passionate contribution. It isn't just I'm going to go do something separate and different than everything in my ordinary life, that I can use the email I'm already on. I can use the yoga class I go to, or I can use my commute to work to be for creating peace by 2014.
Okay.
Vicki, also in a few weeks, we're launching a peacemaker quiz on our website, which is designed to figure out which of the 15 types of peacemaker you tend to be and who you should be working with. And it's like many typologies. You can learn something about yourself and have respect and humor for those types that aren't exactly the ones you would tend to most value, and generally have fun with discovering something about yourself and something about your contribution to the world.
Okay. Now, I asked earlier how we get involved at this at the grassroots level, and you said get the book. But give me a couple of examples there of how we would begin if I wanted to participate, and let's say time is limited, as it is for most people. Where do they begin?
Begin at p5y.org, for peaceinfiveyears.org, and register, because you will get peace action updates. You can register your peace team, your peace buddy online. So that's the first thing to do.
Okay, so there's a little organization behind it, then there's instruction. Is that what you're saying?
That's right. There's a whole movement, and that's what we call P5Y. So there's the book, Give Peace a Deadline, and there's this movement that's actually aimed at meeting our deadline.
One of the chapters in the book, because media is definitely influential, and I am a news junkie, and I have to confess the last couple of weeks I have not wanted to watch it because it's too depressing. But you say update your definition of media. What do you mean by that?
Well, the media we consume affects us. As you say, you don't want to watch the media because of how it affects you. But we say update your definition to understand that all of your conversations and people that you're interacting with are essentially giving and receiving media. We have these mirror neurons, which you may or may not have heard of. When I move my arm, if I see you, then in your brain, the same neurons that move your arm fire off, except for just a few that prevent you from actually moving your arm. So we're modeling everything that we see inside our own being. And that's when we say update your definition of media, is for everyone to be responsible for consuming the media that's both true and inspiring and valuable.
Okay.
Yeah, but our food is media. It makes up our bodies. The conversations we have, it is media. Our home environment is media. Our cars, we're taking in where we live constantly, and that's also what makes up what we say and the actions we take in our life. It isn't just turning on the TV that affects us.
Okay. We've had peace movements over the years, you know, after various wars erupted. I actually, for the very first time in my life, participated in a rally a couple of years ago. But what makes this movement different? What do you think is going to give your movement the legs to carry through?
Well, we're building on all those peace movements of the past that actually started with George Fox and the Quakers in the 1600s. And we see that now is a time when what's new is these tools of mass collaboration, or sometimes call them weapons of mass collaboration, where in the past, when there was a peace march of 100,000 people, there was no organization that had 100,000 email addresses when the march was done to continue to organize and focus the passion of those people. And today, that's what's new. We have a greater flow of information and a greater access to action through just technology. And so that's what's new. And
we're also looking at changing the context altogether. That right now, many of the peace movements have happened to solve one conflict. And we're looking at changing the system in which the conflict happens within, so that it's no longer legitimate for large powers, political powers, to engage in violent conflict and let it escalate past a 6 into a 7, because it's well known that there are tools in a level 1 through 5 to handle conflict. In the 1800s, when people were looking at ending institutional slavery in the United States, there were other ideas on the table, like creating slave licenses so that it's more humane. And we see a very similar correlation to war, that any violent conflict hurts human life, kills people, and is overall just wrong, and the whole legitimacy of it needs to be removed and new actions of how to handle conflict implemented.
Okay, so you've traveled the world. How do different cultures agree or disagree with you and your philosophy on this movement?
We have found a very warm reception in different cultures. Different cultures have different questions about how to do what we're trying to do, but they also see what's new in different ways. And it's been very heartening to see that the universal human values, particularly of safety, everybody wants to be safe, that the value of safety and extending that to the family of humanity, and recognizing that we're really all one world now, even if we haven't been in the past. That is universal across the cultures in everyone that we've talked to.
And it's interesting that some of the most optimistic people we've spoken with are people who've been through war, friends in Lebanon, friends in Uganda, that when someone has lived through a war, they see the necessity of a new way. And, you know, Strauss and Howe, these respected demographers who brought up that crisis is when a new social order can emerge. Well, these people have already lived through the crisis, and they're willing to act. They're willing to do what it takes to make a global agreement of how we handle conflict. And one thing with P5Y that we stand for is protecting all people. And we see that it no longer keeps us safe to just keep our country safe. With the rise of technological advancement, Ray Kurzweil, who's a futurist, said the rate of change right now is 20,000 times what it was 100 years ago. Well, that can both be optimistic and dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
But with this rapid rate of change, it takes a higher degree of responsibility for all of us to make sure that change is for good and that we must protect all people, not just our people.
Yeah. Now, of the cultures that you've visited, you've spent time with, do you find there's one that's more peaceable than others?
I think it's fair to say certain cultures are more peaceful. As humans, we're very flexible anthropologically. We can fit ourselves into almost any culture. But Bill Ury, who's a well-known peacemaker and an anthropologist, has studied, you know, hundreds of cultures and written books about it. And he points out that even the cultures that are apparently violent have systems for containing conflict so that they don't become war. And even though they may have revenge killings or things that we really don't agree with, the actual fact of modern warfare is really about, you know, how we carry out those attacks and those wars today among apparently civilized nations. Most of the impetus for war doesn't come from so-called barbaric peoples.
It comes from where, then? I mean,
it comes from our current agreements and systems of what I'd call economic imperialism, and
which is we're all involved in them. One thing that you get clear on after reading "Give Peace a Deadline" is how you and I are both participating in war.
Right.
It isn't just our government, especially in the United States. Our consumer products, our vote, all determine whether or not we go to war or not, whether or not we save human lives or not. So with our global economy, there's no way of getting around our current agreements. Unless we have an agreement to have no war, we're all involved in war. We're all involved in killing. There's no one, unless you're in a cave meditating and living off of air, you are involved in war.
By the way, we spend our dollars.
Yeah.
P5Y is over in 5 years, no matter what you say. You're just going to call a halt to it in 5 years' time. I saw this on your website.
That's right. Yeah.
So you say that success or failure is not the most important factor in the success of P5Y. It's about changing perceptions, asking deep questions.
We say that success is the most important factor. We're setting a goal to create peace in 5 years. If we reach our five-year point and we haven't succeeded, then we need to try something new. That's the point of P5Y, is that, you know, there's been many things tried and many things have worked in peacemakers. We have great examples of how to create peace and examples in Macedonia and Kenya, you know, modern examples of wars that didn't happen because peace safety practices were used. So P5Y is a concerted effort to push the needle to the point where we no longer have war. And if we reach that five-year point, we will look at what we've done and say, okay, what new can we try now? Because we can't stop.
And we see this kind of like the Quakers in the 1800s. If we had ended institutional slavery in the United States in all but one state, would we have really succeeded?
Mm-hmm.
If we had ended institutional slavery in every state but Texas, would we have succeeded? No. And we see the same way with P5Y. If there are 16 conflicts right now that are politically organized and violent, and our goal is to get all 16 to zero by 2014.
Well,
and that zero is success.
Well, I certainly hope we get there. I appreciate you being with us today. And let's go ahead and give out your website again and tell me what you'd like to leave our listeners with today.
Thank you. The website is p5y.org, so peaceinfiveyears.org, or givepeaceadeadline.com, if that's easier to remember. Same website. And I'd like to leave your listeners with knowing that peace is possible. Like, an end to organized political conflict is possible. That it has a deadline of February 14th, 2014, and that they can do something about it, and to include that in their conversations.
I appreciate you both being with us today. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much,
Thank you, Vicki. It's been a delight.
Yes, and thank you, listeners.
My guests, Nathan Otto and Amber Lepton, their book again, Give Peace a Deadline, What Ordinary People Can Do to Cause World Peace in 5 Years. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll be here with Lydia Denworth. She's a writer and editor based in New York City and has written a book called Toxic Truth, A Scientist, A Doctor, and the Battle Over Lead. We'll be right back.
Love wildlife? Then make a real difference by helping PAWS care for sick and injured wild animals. Volunteers help feed and clean the animals until they are well enough to return to the wild. Sign up today and help save a wild life. No experience necessary. All training is provided. Visit PAWS.org or call 425-787-2500.
How many times have you lost the same 10 pounds only to gain 15 or 20 back? How many times have people who've never had a weight problem told you it's easy to lose weight? Just change your eating habits and work out. Coming Monday, March 30th on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, we'll talk with real people who've been overweight for years and who've got the issue under control. Women who've lost large amounts of weight and, more importantly, kept it off. Tune in next Monday at noon for real-world practical advice and simple cooking recipes that can take you from overweight to shapely just in time for summer. Find guest details at conversationslive.net.
Commune with the Pop Oracle on the Radio 8 Ball Show. I'm Andras Jones, the host of the Radio 8 Ball Show, where we answer your questions by picking songs at random and interpreting them as the answers, like picking musical tarot cards. That's the Radio 8 Ball Show on Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Don't miss the Radio 8 Ball Show, Fridays at noon, right here on Alternative Talk, 1150.
1150kknw.com, your connection to Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Welcome back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. And my second guest today says, if you think lead poisoning is just an inner city kid problem, think again. I actually thought it was something that was no longer an issue, but that's not the case. Lydia Denworth is my guest. She's a writer and editor based in New York City. She's a former reporter for Newsweek and bureau chief for People. Her writing on science, education, and social issues has appeared in the New York Times, Red Book, Health, and other publications. Lydia Denworth, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, your book is called Toxic Truth, A Scientist, A Doctor, and the Battle Over Lead. Tell us a little bit about, I have to tell you, first of all, what amazes me, the dangers of lead, when I was researching this, were first reported in Australia in 1904, according to your notes.
Yes, it does take you back, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It knocks you over a little.
In the 1930s, you say, a federal pamphlet was issued warning of the dangers of lead.
Yeah, in toys.
And yet today, thousands of children nationwide are exposed to dangerous levels of lead every day.
I know, and this is the sad truth. I mean, there's two things that are important to know. One is that we have, in fact, made a lot of progress, and this book is, in part, it's a celebration of that progress, although it's also saying it should
never have been this hard and taken this long. And it took these two people, the scientist and the doctor, and the title, Claire Patterson and Herb Needleman, they risked their careers, their reputations. They fought for decades. And one of the things that scared me was, is that what it would take? You know, does every single issue have to have someone who's willing to risk everything to affect change? And I don't know, maybe that might be true. Happily for us, these two people and some of their other allies did do that. They made a lot of progress. We got lead taken out of a lot of big stuff, out of new paint, out of gasoline, out of food processing cans, things like that. And Americans' average lead levels dropped 90%, which is wonderful. However, there are still 300,000 children in this country with elevated lead levels, and lead is a potent neurotoxin. It does real serious harm to a child's nervous system and the brain, and it's just not something we want our kids to be exposed to. And unfortunately, we don't seem to be doing that last bit of the job. We're not finishing the job here, and that's what we need to do. We need the political will and the cultural will to say this is unacceptable.
Yeah, 300,000 kids in America suffering
right.
with lead poisoning.
It used to be millions. We do need to say we went from millions to 300,000, but 300,000 is way too many.
I mean, considering we found out about this in 1904, yes, it's way too many.
105 years is too long. I think we can all agree 105 years is too long and 300,000 is too many. One is too many.
And I think most people probably heard the reports around the holidays about toys from China coming, you know, oh, they've got lead in their paint. But it's not just toys from China, is it? The people in homes, in houses, in schools, in the water even.
Right. I mean, it is what is true is that it's fortunately, the number of possible sources is fewer than it used to be. And still, by far, the most dangerous source is lead paint, is old lead paint, because it has a much higher concentration of lead in it. And so if a child gets hold of that, that really can do serious harm. Kids who have very high levels of lead now, today, that's how they get it, usually. But the thing, and by the way, I should say, that doesn't mean that they're taking big paint chips and they're eating them. Like people think that, oh, you know, maybe it's the problem of the parents who just aren't paying attention while their kid is munching away on paint. Well, that's not true. First of all, lead paint tastes sweet. So we all know, any of us who have kids know that kids will eat anything that's sweet. But it isn't just chips. It's the dust that lead paint creates on the exterior of a house, say, and in the rain, it washes down into the dirt, into the garden, and the kid plays in the garden, and they get lead paint, lead dust on their hands. You as a parent would have no idea that's what it is. And then the kid puts their hand in their mouth, and then it gets ingested into their bloodstream, and then it goes to their brain, and it wreaks havoc. And so, you know, it can happen to anybody, and it happens in houses. And it certainly happens to poor kids living in dilapidated housing, and it's not the fault of the parents. It's the fault of the housing that they are forced to live in and not being well-maintained. It's also a problem, though, for middle-class families living in renovated houses, in old houses, and where the parents go in and they strip the molding, say, and they sand everything down. Well, they're just throwing all that old lead paint out into the air. And so people really have to be aware. I mean, a lot of people know about this now. I do think far more people know that they have to be careful with those kinds of things, but it surprises me to find how many still don't know that, they have to worry.
You actually, this book I read came about as a, you wrote an article for Redbook. To the book.
I was actually already had in mind, I'd heard about Herb Needleman, and I had in mind that his was an interesting story to tell, and it sort of as a way of exploring it, I did this story for Redbook, which was different. It focused on a mother in Maine who had exactly this problem. Her husband was a contractor, no less, you know, and they bought, you know, what was their dream house and in Portland, Maine, and they set about renovating it. And he, of course, is a professional contractor, so he did the work himself. And even as a professional contractor, no one had ever mentioned lead to him. This was in the 90s, I guess. And so their son Sam got seriously poisoned with lead. His levels were up in the 20s. I can't remember the exact number, but, you know, now the CDC says 10 is a level of concern, and in fact, we know that there is no safe level below 10, that lead is doing harm right from the first bit that's in a child's body. And so their son got poisoned, and then his mother, Susan Thornfelt, she started a local activist group in Maine called the Maine Lead Action Project as a result of all this, and said, you know, this is a, she had to change pediatricians to get anyone to test him. I mean, and you know, but this is supposed to be something we know about. They all said, oh, don't worry, it's not, that's not a problem we have, and this is in a state where you have a lot of old houses. So it's clearly something that we haven't quite got enough knowledge about yet, and that's what I hope this book will do. It will. It's not about exactly what to do for lead poisoning, although you can find that on my website, which is lydiadenworth.com, but this book is what is going to inform us about how we should make these decisions and how we should, what has worked in the past and what hasn't, and how we should approach lead today and all the other environmental toxins that we're dealing with.
Yeah, I read in this article, too, that one of the doctors you spoke with at Children's Hospital in Montefiore Medical Center in New York recommended that all children are tested at 1 and 2 years of age.
Right, and that's what's mandatory in New York State, where I live. And so my kids were all routinely tested, for which I was very grateful. I didn't have to be aware of needing to ask for it myself because it's just done. But if you do live in a state where that's not the case, I think you should get tested. The Red Book, the material from the Red Book article on who should get tested and where and when and why is also all on the website and on my website. And, you know, it does give you a little checklist to follow. But any, if you have any of these risk factors, like living in a house pre-1978 or built pre-1978 and other things like that, then why not get tested? It's just a little finger prick, you know. It's a simple thing, and it's prevention is worth a lot here.
Absolutely, and yeah, I'm looking at that list right now, and it just runs you right through what you need to know, the minimum you need to know about lead in your child.
Right, and that's just the place people should start, and then I have links there to other places. But here's the interesting thing. I mean, the frightening thing about knowing the history is that in the 1920s, we mentioned a couple times, 1904, first doctors figure out that lead paint is what's causing childhood lead poisoning. By the 1920s, there's 12 other countries around the world who banned lead from interior paint. In America, we waited until 1978. In the 20s, when those other countries are already banning it in for houses, use inside houses, we are the National Lead, which was the major paint company at the time in this country, was winning marketing awards for the Dutch Boy campaign, which actually marketed lead paint to kids. They had a little coupon that said, give to mother and father, and it showed the bedroom all bright, and at first all drab and gray, and then bright and white with lead paint. And so, you know, in this country, we just have gone about things differently. And imagine if we could say that only children living in houses built pre-1925 were at risk for lead poisoning instead of pre-1978.
Really?
How far fewer children would be at risk.
Really. What amazed me, Lydia, was that it. They often use it, you'll find it on football turf, on playing
yes,
field turf.
Yes, that was news to me. This is a new thing. And what it does is it helps to make the logo of the team a brighter color that's painted in the middle. Well, great. I mean, you know, but this whole argument that you hear again and again and again throughout the century of fighting about this, that the benefits of don't outweigh the costs of this, costs are prohibitive, but I'm sorry, but to me, a brighter logo in the middle of an artificial turf field is just not a benefit that I care about in the least compared to my children's health. If my kids are playing soccer on that field and it's weathering in the sun, and you know, why do that? Here's the bottom line is that lead poisoning is a man-made disease. It's entirely preventable, and the way you prevent it is by not exposing children to lead in the first place. It's very easy. It's a simple thing. And I think we're an ingenious country. There are companies who make artificial turf that is advertised as lead-free. It's entirely possible to do that. It is not necessary to put lead in that turf. And so we just shouldn't do it.
Yeah. The people that you write about in the book, Claire Patterson and Herbert Needleman, they didn't start out as environmental warriors, did they? Why did you choose to write their story and not just do a book on, you know, this is what's bad about lead?
Well, you know, partly because I think that we all like stories about people and we gravitate to stories about people. They're interesting. It's a good way to tell a story. That was one of my major lessons I learned from working for People magazine for a while. Is there's a reason that it's such a popular magazine, and that's because we want to know what other people are doing. But in this case, these two guys, aside from the environmental importance of what they did, I find it's just a fascinating scientific story. Here you have two men who were very successful in their, you know, they were starting out and they were in their 20s and 30s in their careers, one as a pediatrician, the other as a geochemist, with a lot of, you know, promising futures, but they come across this problem. And at the time in the 50s and 60s, well, it was the 50s for both of them when they first met this problem. And people just didn't think it was a big problem. And these two, what's really interesting about them is they had that ability that very few people have to sort of make a leap in their vision and their thought, thinking about it, and to intuit that the problem was much bigger than anybody was recognizing. And when they thought, had those thoughts, they said, well, wait a minute, if it is, we have a major problem and we need to do something about it. So then they started planning research that would help them try to show whether they were right. And that process, following that scientific process, for me was just fascinating and really inspiring. And it's a little bit like a medical mystery in a way, you know, and that's how the book is set up to read. And I think people will find it a surprisingly good read. Some people call it a page-turner even.
I'm looking at some reviews here. It's being called a page-turner, riveting and fascinating, and Green Living featured Toxic Truth as one of eight great green reads for spring.
Yeah, so, yes, I feel rather proud of having written a page-turner about lead.
Well, you
wouldn't have thought it could be done, but it can. And it can because you have these very powerful, interesting people at the center of the story, but also because it is a case study for environmental politics. I've been saying that with all the talk of the economy and President Obama has been reading FDR and things like that, this to me is to environmental politics what FDR is and the Great Depression is to the economy today. It's essential history that we should all be familiar with, and it should inform what we do now about these last remnants of lead that we need to get rid of and all the other environmental toxins that we're dealing with.
Absolutely. And we're at the end of our segment now, Lydia Danworth. I appreciate you being with us today. What final thoughts that you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Well, just that lead, you know, I hope they will go out and buy this book not just because I'm trying to sell books, but because I really think that we as a country will be, the more informed we are, the better armed we are to fight this and to make the right decisions going forward, and that it won't be another 100 years when people are still saying, how have we not got rid of this lead? How have we not dealt with these environmental toxins?
Really? Important
Hope
work.
Hope springs eternal. I think I just, I'm optimistic. I have to be, because there's no other, the other choice is just to keep pulling the covers up over your head.
No, we don't want to do that.
Right.
Well, I thank you so much for being with us, and thank you for sharing this important work with us.
Thank you for having me.
And my guest, Lydia Danworth, her book, again, is The Toxic Truth, A Scientist, A Doctor, and The Battle Over Lead. And you can find her at lydiadanworth.com or just type in Toxic Truth and the name of the book and she'll pop right up, or go to conversationslive.net and that will link out to her as well. Well, my next guest is Eric Tomei. He's a physical therapist in the Metro Detroit area. His passions include financial education, physical fitness, and charity work for organizations such as Gleaners Food Bank and Children's Hospital in Detroit. His book provides a guide for coping with close personal loss, and his goal through book sales is to raise money for Habitat for Humanity in memory of his father. Eric Tomei, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Vicki. Thank you for having me on.
Very welcome. And am I saying your last name right? Is it Tomei?
Yes, that is right. Thank you. I know, because a lot of people sometimes screw that up, so I appreciate it.
So your book is called I Miss My Dad. You lost your father very suddenly, very unexpectedly, at the age of 57. He was 57. Why did you write this book?
You know, Vicki, I wrote this book very simply. A lot of people think that I wrote it for closure, and maybe in some way that was the truth, but really I wrote it for all the people, all the sons and daughters out there who have lost a father or a loved one close to their heart. I wrote it as a way for them to relate that some ordinary person like myself is going through the exact same feelings and thoughts that they are.
Was it cathartic as you went through the process?
You know, that's a good point, Vicki. I think it was. I think I realized that I always had a writer in me, and I think that maybe this brought it out. It was actually a pretty healing experience overall, and I can just hope that everyone who reads I Miss My Dad will bring some sort of closure and feel some sort of closeness to their lost loved one through reading the book of shared thoughts and experiences with my dad.
Now, you started writing this about 4 months after your father died, which surprised me, because sometimes you need to put space between that, but obviously that wasn't the case for you.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, after somebody suddenly dies, or even when somebody dies after a prolonged illness, or, you know, you take a couple, you know, months, maybe even 6 months, for everybody it's a little bit different, but I was dealing with so many different things that I needed just kind of like me time just to reflect on the events that had happened over the past 4 months, and I really wanted to reflect on what a great guy my dad was in helping me, you know, to shape the man that I am today.
You're also very honest in the book, because you also talk about the things that irritated you about him. One thing, for example, he used to slurp his soup because it was too hot, and you say it used to drive me nuts. Why don't you just wait until the soup cools a little bit?
Vicky, I mean, no relationship, no matter who it is between two people, is going to be 100% perfect. And my dad and I, our relationship was, of course, not 100% perfect. And really, I mean, when someone's slurping some soup, I mean, just wait for it to cool down. You know, I mean, I love the guy, don't get me wrong, but, you know, it can get a little annoying sometimes.
Well, I think, there are many, many more positive things that you talk about here. But
absolutely.
What is it you want to say to people who have maybe difficult relationships with parents or estranged from their parents?
Yeah, what I want to say to those people is, as long as you are trying to make some sort of effort or connect in some way, then you've done your part. You know, maybe it won't work out in the end. You know, that's entirely possible. Human nature and relationships are absolutely like that. But, you know, you need to do your part so that you can say to yourself, I've done all I can, you know, to reconnect with an estranged parent or a loved one that's distant from them. You have to make the effort. If the effort isn't reciprocated, then it's time to move on. You know, you've done your part. But don't waste a single second of trying to, you know, make somebody have a relationship with you, because it's not going to work. It absolutely isn't going to work.
Now, since your father died very suddenly, as, you know, many people do, my father, we had 89 days between his diagnosis and his passing.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt I'd said everything to him that I needed to. But as the years go on, you think of other things that you wish you'd said or done differently. What are some of the things that you wish you had maybe done or said to your father?
Yeah, that's a great question, Vicky. Because my dad died so suddenly, there are definitely a lot of things that you want to say to, you know, your dad or your loved one that you don't necessarily get a chance to say when death is sudden. But the one thing that I would like to say to my dad, if he was standing here right in front of my face right now, is I love you, because we never really said that to each other in the 30 years we had together. So that would be the one most important thing that I would say to him, because it just means so much on so many different levels.
You say that macho Western society discourages men from expressing their feelings, but you feel it's beneficial for them to do so.
I do. I mean, I don't see really what the big deal is with saying, I love you, I care about you, give me a hug. I mean, I wouldn't say that I'm an overly huggy person myself, but I do hug, and, you know, and it's a growing process for me, too. I mean, I'm certainly not perfect either, but I think Western society definitely discourages that kind of behavior in a male. So, and I'm hopefully, by the book, I'm trying to break that stereotype.
What is the biggest lesson that you think you've learned from this experience, Eric?
Yeah, the biggest lesson that I've learned from this experience is never take one single minute for granted during the day. You know, you never know when the end of a relationship will come. It could come when you least expect it. Trust me, I've gone through it. And for all those who've lost a loved one, they can tell you the same thing. Never, ever take advantage of any time you have left with a loved one, because you never know when that minute could be your last.
Yeah, definitely. You hope to raise money for Habitat for Humanity. Your father used to go build for them every other year. What is your goal there? What are you trying to achieve?
Yeah, basically, my dad spurred my love of community service and volunteering for charities through Habitat for Humanity. The first charity that we ever volunteered for together was Habitat for Humanity at one of their Blitz builds, where I live here in Metro Detroit. What my goal is to raise $1 million for Habitat for Humanity through the sale of the book and donations that come in. Now, we've raised $1,300 for Habitat for Humanity since April of 2008. I've sold 400 books, and really we're trying to get to that goal, because Habitat for Humanity, I believe, is such a worthwhile organization providing good, affordable housing to those people in need.
Okay. So we're almost at the end of our segment now. What's the one thing you'd like to leave listeners with really quickly?
Really quickly, again, live every moment to its fullest, because you never know when it's going to be the last.
There you go. Wise words. Eric Tomei, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Vicky.
And you can find Eric Tomei. His book is I Miss My Dad. And if you go to conversationslive.net, you can find a link to, just type in his name in the search box, Eric Tomei, and you will find a link to his website there. And I want to thank each of you for joining me today. We'll be back next week. We're going to talk about getting in shape for summer. I keep putting it off myself. I thought maybe this show would give me some impetus. So join me next week, and we'll be talking with two women who struggled for years with their weight and have now kept it off for a long, long time. So they know firsthand what it takes. You can find out more about upcoming guests at conversationslive.net. You can also find Book Talk podcasts at conversationslive.net. Click on Book Talk. And we'll be back next week. Until then, thanks for being with us. Live well, live strong.
How many times have you lost the same 10 pounds only to gain 15 or 20 back? How many times have people who've never had a weight problem told you it's easy to lose weight? Just change your eating habits and work out. Coming Monday, March 30th on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, we'll talk with real people who've been overweight for years and who've got the issue under control. Women who've lost large amounts of weight and, more importantly, kept it off. Tune in next Monday at noon for real-world practical advice and simple cooking recipes that can take you from overweight to shapely just in time for summer. Find guest details at conversationslive.net. Somewhere was a place we could